Welcome to Animal Voices. Today on the show, we have Will Kimlicka, co-author of Zoopolis, A Political Theory of Animal Rights, which he wrote with Sue Donaldson. But first, we have a musical segment from Kevin Tillman of the Vegan Hip Hop Movement.
Greetings, Animal Voices. It's Kevin from the Vegan Hip Hop Movement. This week's soundscape comes from One Below. One Below is an alternative hip hop artist from Pontiac, Michigan. He is well respected for being one half of the rap duo Binary Star and has released a number of well-received solo albums. The song you're about to hear is entitled Rabbit Food off of his Labor album. You can learn more about One Below and other vegan hip-hop artists on the Vegan Hip-Hop Movement Blogspot, Facebook, and MySpace pages.
Walk on the road. Walk right side. Walk left side. Walk middle, sooner or later, get the squish just like grip. Here karate, same thing, either you karate do yes, or karate do no. You karate do guess so, just like grip. Understand?
Let us begin, the veggie table of contents. I give you a prawn snippet, when the DJ start to spit it. I put the songs on wax, they want a couple pairs. Search the barrel for bad apples, but none is dead. Now I plant seeds and bury the bone in different area codes on blackberries, Macintosh or Windows. Easy appeal like bananas, the man with the plantain, keeping it organic over these golden beats. I am so sweet, a different grain, I'm known to rice on the beach. You can say I'm a fun guy, party in the plush room. You feelin' blue in your small world, mushrooms. It ain't hard to tell a smurf from a gargamel. Father, son, Zeus, strategy behind my art of sale. Protect your nectarine, cause all these crabs in the bucket just wanna see your record sales plummet.
I stand you people right here in Boston, they're at the beach all this next week, is that right?
Yeah, it'd be some weird, oh, it'd be some weird folks out here next weekend.
Cause there's a lot of people hook the beach. Yeah, some people hook the beach like little drug addicts hook the dope. Yeah, it's beef addicts. Yeah, you laughing now, but next week you walk down the street, see him laying in the gutter shaking.
Crime pays, but you're not a felon. Honeydew jail waiting for dispatch like a watermelon. I'm in the limelight, not because my art is selling rhymes. Automatic lemon squeeze like a Mac 11. Now who's that? Pecan through my window. Nobody now, that's tomato. I say tomato, I'm 24 karat underground. Just imagine if my sound made a mango. They say it's for the love and the passion fruit. That's when I say get these nuts. We got checks to cashews. I got an academia in macadamia. Never like a pimp artichoke. Slap a ladies up. Metaphor, pickles in a jar. Or I might blaze grapes in the face. Still raising a bar. And you granola MCs can't handle those. I see cabbage folk, you see antelope. Green machine like Mikhail Kevin. I'm chilly chill, red is familiar. My name ring a bell pepper. Stalking your ears, you might turn corn. Same rappers turn pop when the heat turn on. When the flame turn orange, time to do that shit. If it's still hard to believe, I'll prune that shit. Pomegranate, don't panic. I'm the cherry on top of the ice cream. I squash beef, thank you very much, peace.
Did you not spill the blood of the old man when his oil and gasoline was still useful to us?
We have our own fuel now from the corn.
Green eyes tell green lies. A friend dies from trucking on truth. Knowledge is fruitful, but sometimes battling provide enemies. Trojan horse your ass. Vampires of the stark stalking hope, knocking dope and inorganic impotence in instances where lies reach distances. And that's not a carrot. It's an erection. Pesticide. STD. Subway transmitted disease.
Daddy, I know what I can draw. Look what I can draw.
You're making the cracks look better. I like that. First thing artists try to do, one thing they try to do is make things look better. They try to make, you know, you see an ugly wall, they try to paint on it and make it look better. You made a swing set?
Uh-huh.
That's what's up. Aya, what you making?
USC.
Huh?
USC.
Okay.
I made an A.
Oh, you made an A.
Yeah. Welcome to Animal Voices. I'm your host, Daniel Angrenon. Today we will be speaking with Will Kimlicka, co-author of the book Zoopolis, A Political Theory of Animal Rights. He's the Canadian Research Chair in Political Philosophy at Queen's University. He's also published many books and articles and is the co-director of the Multiculturalism Policy Index Project. His book Zoopolis explores animal rights theory pragmatically by extending rights of citizenship, denizenship, or sovereignty to non-human animals. The book takes a thorough and comprehensive look at how other animals fit in with our society and the ethical obligations that accompany it. Welcome to the show, Will Kimlicka.
Thanks, Dan.
No problem. So to start off, what was the impetus that encouraged you and Sue Donaldson to craft this political theory of animal rights?
Well, one motivation was professional shame, if you like. I'm a political philosopher, and it's really quite embarrassing how little political philosophy has contributed to the debate on animal rights. Political philosophy is concerned with issues about government, about political community, about the state. And of course, in reality, all of those issues are intimately linked up with animals. On a day-to-day basis, we're governing millions of animals. We're governing where they live. We govern whether their habitat is protected or developed. We govern what kind of mobility they have, what kind of lives they lead. And so you would have expected that the treatment of animals would be a fundamental question for political philosophy. But I'm embarrassed to say that you can still be trained as a political philosopher, both at the undergraduate and graduate level, and really never even be exposed to the animal question. The animal question has not really penetrated into the field of political philosophy. And so one of my motivations was just to persuade my colleagues that if we're going to be writing about issues of political community and citizenship and boundaries and territory and the state, we need to think about animals. And so in that sense, I just want my field to catch up with the rest of other disciplines like sociology or even moral philosophy, which have been interested in the animal question for a long time. The second motivation, perhaps more important, is that my hope is that political philosophy, once it starts taking the animal question seriously, may actually have something useful to contribute to the debate. And my hope is actually that political philosophy can help us solve one of what I take to be the really fundamental challenges facing animal advocacy at the moment, which we might call the puzzle about rights and relationships. So let me just explain. I mean, on the one side, we have traditional animal rights theory, which has been very firm and uncompromising in its commitment to animal rights, but which has said very little, if anything, about the ways in which we can positively relate to animals. And indeed, if you look carefully at many of the most influential accounts of animal rights, they often implicitly or explicitly imply that we shouldn't be having any relationships with animals. We should just leave them alone, and that the goal, so that the animal rights utopia would be a world in which there's humans over here and animals over there, and the two would never have any interaction. So Ralph Acampora calls this the idea of species apartheid, and it seems to me quite pronounced in some of the traditional animal rights views. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are a lot of critics of that in the animal advocacy movement, from a variety of perspectives, feminist care ethics, various animal welfareists, or various post-humanists, who emphasize that it's inevitable and appropriate and desirable for humans to have ongoing relationships of interdependency and cooperation and physical proximity with animals. So they rightly emphasize the need for a much more relational account of animals. But they are often very critical of the idea of animal rights. They think we need to abandon this discourse of animal rights. And the inevitable result is that they end up opening the door to exploitation. And so, in my view, most of the leading accounts of feminist care ethics towards animals or post-humanist accounts of animals end up legitimating forms of animal experimentation or the use of animals for food. So basically, this is a dilemma. We have relationship rights. We have rights without relationships in the traditional animal rights view, and we have relationships without rights in these alternative approaches. But what I think we need is an account that combines an uncompromising commitment to animal rights with a recognition of the inevitability and desirability of ongoing relations of interdependency and cooperation. And that's where I think political philosophy can help. You could say that this has been the fundamental task of political philosophy as a discipline, at least for the last several decades, as to combine a commitment to universal human rights, which are owed to all human beings, with a theoretical exploration of the kinds of relational rights that emerge from the fact that we are members of different political communities. Some people are our co-citizens to whom we have special rights and relation and responsibilities. Some people are our visitors, our migrants, tourists, to whom we have a different kind of relationship. Yet other human beings are members of their own sovereign political communities living in their own distinct states, and we have yet different rights and responsibilities in relation to them. So political philosophy has, as it were, part of its raison d'etre, is to think both simultaneously about the importance of universal basic rights, as well as what we might call membership rights or citizenship rights. And so in the human case, we're quite familiar with this idea that it's possible to combine an uncompromising principled commitment to basic rights with the recognition of relationships and membership. And so we're just, in this book, we're basically trying to draw lessons from that for the animal case.
Mm-hmm. So before we expand further, would you be able to talk about these three different types of relationships of domesticated animal citizens, liminal animal denizens, and sovereign wild animals?
Yeah, sure. The first category we work with is domesticated animals. And our argument there is that the very process of domestication should be understood as a process that brought those animals into our societies. We have made them members of our society, and we therefore should extend to them membership rights. And, I mean, we have bred them over a long period of time to become dependent on us and to be able to fit into schemes of cooperation that we have devised. So we owe them membership. And as a political philosopher, whenever I hear the word membership, I immediately think of citizenship. That's the tool that we use in the human case to recognize membership. If someone is a member of society, we recognize that by attributing them citizenship. And so we suggest that domesticated animals should quite literally be seen as our co-citizens, and that there would be a distinctive set of rights and responsibilities that are owed to domesticated animals as our co-citizens, as members of our society. That's quite different from the case of wilderness animals, or what we might call truly wild animals, who far from having been brought into our society, try as much as possible to avoid human contact, who live on their own wild habitats, and which are, of course, regrettably shrinking all the time, but who are trying as best they can to live independently of humans on their own separate habitat. And we suggest that those wild animal communities are best seen as having their own sovereignty over their own homelands, if you like, their own habitats. And so that our relationships to those truly wild animals should be seen as a relationship between sovereign communities, which would mean, amongst other things, that their territory is theirs, not ours. We have no right to colonize it, to develop it. We need to recognize that land is theirs. And then in between those two categories are what we call liminal animals, they're not domesticated, so they have not been captured and bred, selectively bred by humans. But they're not living on their own separate wild habitat. They have basically, for a variety of reasons, moved in amongst us. They've, and in many cases, actually actively seek out areas of human habitation because it might provide more food supply than is available in the wild, or because they have stronger protection against their predators. And so if you think about, squirrels, Canada geese, pigeons, mice, and so on. These are raccoons. These are familiar examples of liminal animals. And we think they're a special case because the fact that they're not domesticated means that, unlike domesticated animals, they're not really bred for or trained for close cooperative relationships with human beings. They are still wild in that sense. And so, unlike domesticated animals, they're not typically interested in or able to have close, trusting, cooperative, communicative relations with humans. So the model of citizenship that we offer for domesticated animals doesn't really work for them because it presupposes this quite intimately cooperative relationship. But on the other hand, we can't just leave them alone the way we might with sovereign, truly wild animals, because they're living amongst us. They live in our houses, in our attics, in our basements, our garages, our backyards, our trees. And so what we propose is that we need a new status for them, which recognizes that they live amongst us, so they have rights of residency. This is where they live. We shouldn't say they don't belong here, but they're not co-citizens. And so we need a looser and more, a relationship based more on kind of tolerant coexistence rather than a more intimate cooperative participation as with domesticated animals. So that's what we call denizenship, this mix of residency rights with a looser, more tolerant form of coexistence.
Great. Thank you very much. That was very concise. So going back to what you were saying before, talking about the species apartheid, I really appreciated in your book there was the critique of the extinctionist argument, and similar to this apartheid argument, where the idea of domesticated animals are not their full selves, that, you know, all animals should be wild, and that they should either be bred out of existence or, you know, return to the wild. And this idea of, you know, you and Sue mentioned that, you know, we shouldn't be punishing animals for the status that they've come to live in. And I think a lot of people would definitely relate to this in terms of cats and dogs, but I was wondering if you could maybe elaborate further about the animals that are used for food, for experimentation, and in terms of how we can care for their care in populations in a zoopolis society?
Yeah, so it's very important to emphasize that the category of co-citizens applies to all domesticated animals, not just companion animals. And this is one of our points of difference with at least some of the other relational accounts of animal ethics, which, you know, so various other accounts say that we have close, intimate relations with companion animals, and therefore we have strong ethical duties towards them, but only weaker obligations to farm animals or to lab animals because they're not as close to us. Whereas the moral basis for our argument is not emotional closeness in the first instance. It's rather the fact of domestication. It's precisely the fact that we have taken animals out of the wild and bred them over generations, if not over centuries, to become dependent on us. That's what generates the rights of membership and hence the rights of citizenship. And so it does apply as much to farm animals and to lab animals as to companion animals. And we think in all of these cases that, of course, the initial process of domestication was coercive and exploitative, and the current status of most of these animals is a highly unjust one. But they are certainly all capable of good lives, and we owe it to them to enable them to lead good lives as members of our society. And so we think on the one hand that, as I say, involves firstly recognizing their membership. Step is to truly accept that they are members of our society, and as I say, that we think that's best acknowledged through the tool of citizenship. And then secondly, in virtue of their membership and their citizenship, to try to make the rules of our shared society responsive to their interests. This is one of the fundamental goals of any citizenship model, is to make the shared, you know, if we're all subject to shared governance, the task of citizenship is to make the rules of that shared governance responsive to all of our interests. And so we need to think about what would be the mechanisms by which we can make our governance practices as responsive to the interests of domesticated animals as it is to the interests of humans, the human members of society. And so in relation to horses and cows, as much as to dogs and cats, our focus is on asking what kinds of relationships, if any, do they want with us? You know, so we shouldn't assume that the purposes of their life are already predetermined by the purposes that we have for them. That's the old exploitative model. We should instead open up the question and say what kinds of relationships they have been bred to be able to cooperate with us, but that doesn't predetermine what are the purposes of our cooperative activities. And those cooperative activities, as I said, should be as responsive to their goals and interests and subjective good as to ours. And so we try to, I mean, this is obviously quite speculative, and this will be a very long-term project, but the goal is to try to create the conditions under which domesticated animals can communicate to us what kinds of relationships they want to have with us. And that's one of the fundamental goals of citizenship, is to put that question on the table.
I think that's really important, because there's a lot of us making the decisions about them, but without them. And I think you talk about this in your comparison to the disability rights movement. Both groups have had challenges in having their self-advocacy heard, but they've both come a long way. So what lessons do you think the animal rights movement can learn from the disability rights movement?
Yeah, so we've been very much inspired by a lot of the recent work in the disability movement, and in particular, the literature around citizenship for people with intellectual disability. And one lesson, I mean, one fundamental argument that has emerged from that literature is the need to avoid simplistic dichotomies between autonomy or dependent. Most of us have a natural tendency to try to put people into boxes. And so we say that some people are autonomous and others are not. They're dependent. But in reality, as the disability movement emphasizes over and over again, we should think about autonomy and dependence as, first of all, a scale rather than a simple dichotomy, but also that it's a multidimensional scale. People can be competent in some fields of life without being competent in all of them. And these are features that change over time. So we're all born into conditions of dependency, most of us at an elder age become more revert, if you like, to dependency. And so autonomy is something that we achieve in some domains at some stages of our life. That's true of all of us. So we all go through different kinds of stages and conditions of combinations of autonomy and dependency. And we all move through this kind of evolving stages and webs of interdependency. So in place of this old model of a simple dichotomy between autonomous people and dependent people, we should instead think about this much more complex story about evolving mixes of interdependency. And the second lesson that follows from that is that wherever one is, at any given stage in one's life, there are always things we can do to enable people to more effectively express their subjective good. And there are always things we can do as a society to make our institutions and our practices more responsive to the subjective good of people. So no matter where they are in this continuum, and so in the case of the intellectual disability literature, no matter how severe the intellectual disability may be for a particular person regarding a particular aspect of life at a particular point in time, there are always things we can do to elicit their subjective good, to try to find ways to enable them to communicate, not necessarily verbally, not necessarily through articulating arguments, but nonetheless to communicate through their eye movements, through their bodily movements, through their noises and so on, what their subjective good is, and to make sure that our institutions are responsive to that subjective good. And we would argue that all of that applies perfectly well to the case of domesticated animals, that whatever their intellectual capacities, wherever they are on this continuum or scale, there are ways in which we can elicit the expression of their subjective good, and there are ways in which we can make our rules responsive to that subjective good.
In terms of our domesticated animal citizens, how do we find the balance between, you know, reproductive rights and agency versus, you know, the idea of, I hate to use this word, but like population management in terms of stray cats and dogs or et cetera? Just curious if you could expand on that a little.
to be honest, we found this, Sue and I found this the most probably the single most difficult issue to grapple with. And I think it points to a real, it's a problem for us, but it's a problem for animal rights advocates and animal rights theorists of any stripe. I think this is one of the real gaps. There's a lot of sophisticated animal rights theory out there, but I don't believe that we have good theories about the reproductive rights of domesticated animals or liminal animals. So there's more work to be done, including for us. But just the quick answer would be, we certainly don't think that we can just assume unilaterally that we have the right to spay and neuter domesticated animals because they're, I mean, without reference to their subjective good. That would just be another example of a lack of citizenship. So we need the whatever rules we adopt regarding reproduction need to be based on this premise that the domesticated animals are our co-citizens, and certainly we don't go around forcibly sterilizing human citizens, so we should be very cautious about the thought that we would have the right to do that for our domesticated animal co-citizens. On the other hand, there is a dilemma, which is that precisely because they're accorded co-citizenship, that means that we, humans, are responsible for the well-being of the offspring of domesticated animals. And there are, I think, limits of feasibility on that. So, and again, precisely because our theory extends citizenship rights to domesticated animals, this isn't just a matter of not killing them or... Citizenship, on our view, includes, for example, rights to public health care. We think there should be a public insurance scheme for health care for domesticated animals. Now, that's very costly, and that would extend not just to existing domesticated animals, but to their offspring. Mm-hmm. And that will quickly become financially very burdensome if there's absolutely no limits on the reproduction of domesticated animals. And so, our inclination is to think that the domesticated animals probably do have a condition in a qualified right to reproduce. That's to say, I think it probably is part of the good life for many domesticated animals that they be able to have a family, to have family relationships. And that's one of the horrors of the existing industrialized agriculture is that we prevent cows from having a relationship with their offspring. So I think it is important that we enable domesticated animals to have offspring and to have family relationships, but not unlimited. And so we contemplate the possibility that maybe after, you know, that the domesticated animals might have the right to have one round, if you like, of offspring, one litter or maybe two, but that at some point it might become permissible to limit their reproduction, having given them the opportunity to have a family, on grounds of feasibility, because otherwise the citizenship model won't work.
Yeah, and I think even in terms of what you were talking about, healthcare and just general like well-being of the offspring and whatever, I mean, we see that with human populations as well.
I should have said that. So we discuss a bit about the. At the moment, we don't put right limitations on human reproduction, and one of the consequences of that is that we are continually expanding onto the territory of wild animals because we can't live within our own means, and so we keep taking over and colonizing the territory of wild animals. And on our view, we have no right to do that. Part of our goal in allocating sovereignty to wild animals is to stop humans from taking over the territory of wild animals. And if we do that, I think that will inevitably mean that humans need to regulate their reproduction. We need to keep our numbers within feasible limits, given that we can't continue to take over the territory that belongs to other animals. And so I think part of our, you know, the long-term implication of our story is that humans will also have to rethink the size of the human population.
Mm-hmm. And I think the thing is, with your book, what I really do appreciate is, in all these aspects, you're really approaching it from, you know, a practical, what could work, you know, and if there's something that's still up in the air, you know, we still need to think about it, but it's, you understand that society, you know, has its gray areas and government has its gray areas. And I think that's a really great part of your book. Now I was wondering if we could change gears a bit. and talk a bit about wild animals. I really like the idea you have of sovereignty, and I think it forms a definitely a more concrete way of defining the relational rights and duties between humans and wild animals. So my first question, though, and we touched about this a little bit in the first half of the interview, is that wild spaces are decreasing due to stuff like climate change, human development, etc. So what would you propose needs to happen in terms of this shrinking sovereign land for animals? How can we deal with that?
Well, so as I said before, part of our goal in invoking this idea of sovereignty is to emphasize that what's left of wildlife, of wilderness, that territory is simply not ours. We should think of it from the point of view of international justice, that those lands are simply not ours to do with as we please. And this is different from, I mean, lots of people who work in animal ethics have talked about the importance of preserving habitat, but it's often still framed under the assumption that human political communities have fully legitimate sovereign rights over wilderness. And then the question is, you know, whether you can create some form of reserve or conservation area that can help to protect wilderness as an exercise of our sovereign authority over that territory. But I think, just at least from an intellectual and political theory point of view, we need to shift our lens and instead think that it's just not our territory. And I think that's analogous to debates around the rights of indigenous peoples, that in relation to indigenous peoples, we shouldn't think of ourselves as, you know, granting them some form of autonomy or self-government. The point is rather it's their territory, it's their land. And we should recognize them as having pre-existing rights over that land. And so part of our concern is that these other models for protecting habitat and protecting wilderness, they always just are vulnerable to claims that, you know, that the resources on that territory are too valuable, or that there's some need we have as human beings to build roads through it or whatever. And so we don't yet have the tools, legal or intellectual, to act, that have actually served as an effective break on the human colonization of wild animal habitat. And so our proposal is to call a spade a spade. It is colonization. It's exactly colonization. And we have strong international law that prohibits the colonization of humans' territory. So why not contemplate establishing legal protection against the colonization of animal territory? And, I mean, obviously I'm not particularly optimistic that we're likely to get the international community to agree on this idea of sovereign rights for wild animals. But, I really am skeptical that we're going to have much success through any other legal tool.
Mm-hmm. Like, it does seem that the most realistic, even if it is not a very optimistic model. Well, do you have any suggestions for how you think you could get politicians on board with the idea of that animals' well-being, you know, matters to the animals themselves, you know, as opposed to just figuring out the animal question?
Well, that's a $64,000 question.
Yeah.
And it's not just politicians. I mean, it's the broader public as well. In a democracy, you're not going to get very far persuading politicians if you're not simultaneously changing public opinion. Well, so, I mean, part of our thought is that there are so many examples out there of individuals coming to appreciate the lives of animals in very specific contexts. And, of course, the usual one is with companion animals. People come to have an understanding of the uniqueness and the subjectivity of the individual dog or cat that they're living with. And so they're in these very specific contexts, people do come to realize that animals have an inner life. They have a subjective view of the world. They have a subjective experience of the world, and that they have, in many cases, a kind of rich palette of emotions. And it, obviously, on any plausible story, those those characteristics and capacities are not, they're equally found in farm. I mean, there's no possibility. It makes no scientific sense to think that these are somehow limited to companion animals. If our companion animals have these capacities, and so obviously do farm animals and lab animals and liminal animals and wild animals. And for some reason, so many people are unable to make the connection between what they fully recognize the subjectivity of the individual animal that they live with, but are unable to extend that and to think about what it must be like to be a cow or a pig in today's farm factories, or to be a lab animal. And I mean, this is, of course, a huge, for those of us in the movement, it's a huge puzzle. How is it that people are unable or unwilling to make that extension? And I don't have any miraculous answer, except to say that I do think it's important to try to build off this. If we think of companion animals as the gateway experience to animal rights, which it is for many people, that makes it all the more important that we don't adopt a picture of animal rights which discounts all relations between humans and companion animals, which is one of the, I think, risks of the traditional animal rights approach, which is so scathing of and contemptuous of domesticated animals, that we should instead have our story of animal rights should take what's best in that relationship between humans and domesticated animals, and then try to figure out ways to institutionalize it, which is basically what we're trying to do with this citizenship model, so that it's no longer dependent on the individual goodwill of a particular human who's caring for a companion animal, but rather we start to build social institutions that are predicated on a relationship of, again, of cooperation and trust and mutual respect. And so, you know, the thought is that most people actually do have some experience of the possibility of a just relationship that recognizes and is responsive to the subjective good of animals, their individual uniqueness and their subjectivity. I think most of us have, at least at some moment, in some part of our life, have an experience of that. And we just need to figure out a way to get people to realize that's relevant for animal issues generally.
Really, really well put. One issue I was the role of capitalism in terms of this zoopolis. I mean, many non-humans as of now are commodified as products or as labor. How do you think these ones would be protected from exploitation? Would it require like a complete overhaul, or would there be some way of kind of developing new ideas to change that relationship? What are your insights on that?
Well, the imperatives of capitalism obviously drive a lot of the existing exploitation of animals. I mean, most obviously in the food industry, but also with lab animals. I mean, just reading again, yet again, that the numbers are going up, the use of animals for experimentation is going up, not down. And that's partly because drug companies and other biomedical companies are finding huge sources of profit from the exploitation of animals. So clearly the profit motive is having this very pernicious effect in intensifying animal exploitation. On the other hand, I mean, that's not unique to the case of animals. You could think also, in some of my other work, I've worked on the rights of indigenous peoples, and you could say the same thing in that case, that the imperatives of capitalism are driving this kind of voracious, ferocious search for natural resources all around the globe, which often in many countries means trying to get onto the territory of indigenous peoples and to exploit the resources in their territories. And you could say the same thing about migrant workers. So capitalism poses these risks of exploitation across the board, across the species, as well as across international boundaries. But in relation to indigenous peoples and migrant workers and others, we don't say, you know, let's wait for the overthrow of capitalism before we think about how to extend justice. Even though we know capitalism is part of the problem, we can't wait until we figure out what exactly is the alternative to capitalism. We do the best we can to achieve justice here and now. And so we fight for things like the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And I think that those projects are meaningful. I think that sticking with the indigenous rights case, that the international movement for the rights of indigenous peoples hasn't overthrown capitalism, but it has certainly created meaningful protections for indigenous peoples. And it's important to emphasize that the tool that's being used to create those protections is precisely these ideas of citizenship and membership. So we think of indigenous peoples both as citizens of their own self-governing communities, as well as having citizenship rights in larger political communities. And our constructions, our attempt to theorize these ideas of overlapping sovereignties and overlapping citizenships are important for ensuring justice. And I would say the same thing is relevant for the case of animals, that there's a lot of scope for using these ideas of citizenship and membership and sovereignty to improve the protections we have to animals. And we're definitely not going to get to utopia through these kinds of mechanisms. They're always going to be vulnerable to the imperatives of the state and the imperatives of capitalism, but I don't think we should underestimate the benefits that can come from using the tools that are available even in today's world.
Mm-hmm. Going back a minute, you did mention migrant workers, and I was wondering if we could expand a bit on that. One of the comparisons you make in your book is between human migrant workers and liminal animal denizens, about how they live and they're part of the society, but not full citizens. But I also noticed that, you know, there's definitely some negative comparisons, we'll say, such as the idea of, you know, being illegal or being a pest. So in what ways do you think the denizenship of both human and non-humans can be improved?
Yeah, well, this is a fundamental challenge in both cases, both in the human and animal case. So as I just said in answer to the previous question, I think that the tool of citizenship has been effective. That doesn't solve all the problems of the world, but a variety of groups have struggled for citizenship. I mean, we've witnessed a series of what are often called citizenship movements by women, by racial minorities, by people with disability, gay rights. All of these are struggles for citizenship, and in part because citizenship is the most effective tool we have developed for ensuring relations of inclusion, participation, some forms of mutual respect. And so citizenship has been worth struggling for. And because it's been an effective tool, in many contexts, progressives have been inclined to think that it's the only tool that we have available, and that the goal must always be to bring everyone into the framework of citizenship, including, for example, migrant workers. This is an ongoing debate on the left about migrant workers, whether the goal should always be to extend citizenship. But on our view, in both the human and the animal case, not everyone is able to or interested in joining a particular scheme of citizenship. Because citizenship is a very specific sort of relationship. It involves, as I said before, it involves a quite intimate cooperative relationships of trust and participation, and with quite extensive rights and responsibilities. And for some people, for some groups, It's actually the kind of rigors, if you like, of cooperative citizenship in today's society are incompatible with their own aspirations and their own way of life. So one of the examples we consider is the case of the Amish in the United States, a very, very conservative, traditionalist, ethno-religious group, which does not want to participate in the practices of American citizenship. For example, they don't want to participate in juries, they don't want to serve in the military, they don't want to contribute to the pensions, public pension scheme, but because they find all that, basically they find the modern state corrupt, and they don't want to have anything to do with it. And but they live in the territory of the United States, and they belong there. And so what they have pursued is a status which recognizes the legitimacy of their presence, gives them, if you like, residency requirements, but allows them to have a much looser relationship to the American state, in which they have fewer responsibilities, like they're exempted from juries and military service, but also they don't exercise the same rights, so they waive their right to various public benefits, like welfare state benefits, and they avoid using the courts to resolve their own disputes and so on. And so that's one of the so they opt out of citizenship in order to maintain a kind of denizenship, residency in the United States, but not full participation in its scheme of cooperative citizenship. And this is, I mean, we need to be honest that this is a risky status, because whenever people opt out of citizenship or are denied citizenship, they are always vulnerable to being accused of being disloyal, or being alien, or being, you know, they're vulnerable to being scapegoated and stigmatized. But on the other hand, the reality is that's the only way they can maintain the way of life that they cherish, is if they opt out of at least some of the practices of cooperative citizenship. And we would argue the same is true about liminal animals, that, they're definitely vulnerable to being stigmatized as pests and saying that they don't belong in the city. And you might worry that by according them the status of denizens rather than citizens, that we're not providing firm enough protection. But the reality is that we could only extend citizenship to them if we radically disrupted their way of life. We could only extend citizenship to them basically if we domesticated them and turned them into our pets, if we captured them and caged them and trained them and socialized them so that they're capable of the same sort of intimate cooperative relationship that we have with our companion animals or with farm animals. And we just don't believe that that's what liminal animals want. They have a way of life that they cherish, which involves a degree of independence from us. They look after their own food, they look after their own reproduction. And so the idea of denizenship, it's a risky status, both in the human and the animal case, but we think it's we need it, that both human and animals are diverse. We need models of belonging and models of membership that are responsive to the full diversity of human ways of life and animal ways of life.
Mm-hmm. So in the conclusion of your book, you mentioned that animal rights theory has generally won some battles but is losing the war. So what solutions do you see that can help, you know, turn some small victories into bigger victories?
Well, I'm not particularly optimistic in the short term. I do think we've lost the war. The number of animals being harmed and killed for human benefit increases every day. And every projection I've seen suggests that they will continue to increase. Those numbers will continue to increase for the next 20, 40, 50 years. And I would love to believe that a kind of revolution in public sentiments is around the corner, but I don't think it is. So I think things are grim in the short to midterm. But this whole, the way in which society is addicted to the exploitation of animals is, in the longer term, totally unsustainable, if only from an environmental point of view. And there's just no way that humans continue to feed themselves on a meat diet. It's completely environmentally unsustainable. And so at some point, there will be a crisis. And that's what I think we need to be. That's when I think new possibilities will emerge, and we need to be ready for that, and ready not just intellectually in the sense that we need the right kinds of theories and concepts that we could appeal to at that moment of crisis, but I also think we need to have had experiments in practice. We need to, they will have to be small scale to begin with, but I think what the movement needs is, and of course what we already have, and in many places, is attempts to create experiments of these sorts of relationships we've been discussing. So sanctuaries, for example, like the farm sanctuary for domesticated animals, or wildlife sanctuaries for liminal animals. Are examples that are trying to show in practice that these sorts of relationships are possible. And you could also think about the ways in which people are struggling to improve the status of their companion animals. So, for example, struggles for dog parks, which are struggles in part that can be seen as an attempt to promote the principle that the city doesn't just belong to humans, but public space belongs to companion animals as well. And there are many experiments in promoting tolerant coexistence for liminal animals as well. So what we see, I think, on the ground is a lot of really fascinating and inspiring experiments to create what we would describe as, experiments in co-citizenship for domesticated animals, experiments in denizenship for liminal animals, experiments in sovereignty for wild animals. These are still small scale, and as I said, I'm not optimistic that they're going to win the day in the short to midterm. But when the crisis comes, and it will, I think those experiments will prove to be hugely influential in giving us a picture of what's possible down the road.
Thanks for being on the show. The book is Zoopolis, A Political Theory of Animal Rights. You can find it at Oxford University Press or OUP.com. I've also seen it in bookstores, and feel free to check it out. It's really a great read. Animal Voices is broadcast at CFBU 103.7 FM in St. Catharines and CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. If you have any comments, questions, or show ideas, we'd love to hear from you. So contact us at animalvoices@gmail.com or feel free to get a hold of us through our Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr pages. Thank you very much to our team, audio techs Aaron O'Sullivan and Neil Harvey, Taylor Book with social media, and music collaborator Kelvin Tillman. And an extra special thank you to Megan Ishida for today's episode. I'm Daniel Angrenon, and I hope you all have a great day. Thanks for listening.